This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Parker Palmer trusts messiness and disorder and tension even, at least when it comes to societies and politics. He notes that on the streets of totalitarian societies, there is great cleanliness and a lack of spontaneous rallies. By contrast, he says, the genius of democracy is that it does not propose to clean up that messiness of conflicting ideas. Palmer argues that the American experiment with democracy works when it embraces what he calls the tension of ideas. A sociologist by training, Palmer laid out his views of America's democratic experiment in a recent speech at the Commonwealth Club of California. And it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Parker Palmer is the author of several books on education and American society, including The Courage to Teach and A Hidden Wholeness. A decade ago, he founded the Center for Courage and Renewal, which was started to inspire and sustain public school teachers. 10 years on, it offers retreats to other professionals as well. He's also a senior advisor to the Fetzer Institute in Michigan, which works to bridge scientific insights with the mind and spirit. Palmer is also a Quaker, and he spoke of another Quaker in history when he gave his speech at the Commonwealth Club of California on February 19th.
I want to start by telling you a little-known story from the earliest days of this American experiment in democracy. It's a story of a person driven by the deepest of democratic impulses. It's an 18th century story with so many 21st century parallels that it reveals, I think, how truly unfinished our democratic experiment is. And it's a story that offers us guidance about what you and I must do if we want to keep alive this powerful, precious, but always precarious experiment in government of, by, and for the people. It's the story of a man named John Woolman, born 1720, died 1772, a Quaker by faith, a tailor by trade, whose family helped found New Jersey. John Woolman lived among Quaker merchants and farmers whose religious convictions affirmed the equality of all people, in Quaker language, that of God in every person. But their wealth, as merchants and landed gentry, depended upon the evil called slave labor. John Woolman, alone in his community, had it, as he said, laid upon him by the Lord that slavery was wrong and that Quakers were called to free their slaves and to do so now. In the Quaker style, he took this to his Quaker meeting, his congregation, and they wrestled with it through a process that we know as consensual decision making, where you don't make a decision until the whole group is ready to move together. After a while, two things became evident. John Woolman's integrity around this issue was unimpeachable. Nobody could argue that this was a false prophet with a false prophecy. But most of the Quaker merchants and farmers were unwilling to give up the slaves on whom their wealth was based. So they did an extraordinary thing. They said, John Woolman, because of your integrity, because of the authenticity of your stand, we will support your family and you for as long as it takes you to travel among us, preaching your prophecy, witnessing to your truth, to see what happens as time unfolds. We have a process that disallows us from laying this down. We're going to have to hold the tension over a period of time as long as it takes for us to see what new revelation might be open not only in you, but among all of us. And so, for 20 long years, John Woolman traveled up and down the East Coast of the United States, carrying his message everywhere he went. And he walked his talk with every step, continuing to act out this integrity, this authenticity, which had so touched his community. When he was at a remote farmhouse, about to partake of a meal and realized that that meal had been prepared or was being served by slaves, he would fast. He would refuse to eat. But he would stay at table, speaking with people, conveying the truth that he knew and understood. If he received something that he learned had been made by slaves, he would insist upon paying for that item. 20 long years, he walked his talk, and during that time, his message was not well received by many friends who were and are as adept as anyone at contradicting their own beliefs. But finally, after 2 decades, Quakers saw the light and realized that Woolman had a prophecy that applied not just to him, but to all of them. And 80 years before the Civil War, Quakers became the first religious community in the United States, and indeed the first organized community in the United States, to free their slaves en masse. In 1783, a decade after Woolman's death, Quakers petitioned the U.S. Congress to correct, with legislation, the, quote, complicated evils and unrighteous commerce created by the enslavement of human beings. And from 1827 onward, Quakers played a key role in developing the Underground Railroad. Consensual decision-making is often called an inefficient way of making important decisions, but it seems to me if you get 80 years ahead of the Civil War, in a decision of fundamental moral significance, maybe inefficiency is the wrong word for this way of holding the profound tensions of our common life. What John Woolman did and what his community helped him to do is critical to the flourishing of the democratic experiment. Woolman and his community held the tension between what is and what could and should be, without trying to resolve that tension prematurely and falsely by collapsing into one pole or the other, as we, I'm afraid, too often do. Collapse into the pole called reality, what is, and you find yourself ultimately, I think, falling into corrosive cynicism. Collapse into the other pole of what could and should be, possibility, and you find yourself collapsing into irrelevant idealism. And as different as corrosive cynicism and irrelevant idealism may seem or sound on the surface, they play the same role in our lives. They take us out of the action. They render us irrelevant to the great issues of our time, when we don't know how to hold the tension. What Woolman models for us is a virtue that I call standing in the tragic gap. Standing in the tragic gap. Standing there not inactively or passively, but standing there with energy, with hope, with witness, not with coercion, but with persuasion, calling people forward to new possibilities. The gap is tragic not because it is sad, which is a very diminished meaning of the word. It's tragic in the classic sense because it is inevitable. This gap will always be with us. And if we do not know how to inhabit it with the fullness of our lives, we fall short of the great potentials of democracy. By standing in the gap rather than trying to resolve it prematurely and falsely, we allow the tension to pull us open to new possibilities, to pull our minds open to pull our hearts open, to pull our souls open to what can and should be. Now, it seems to me that a democratic government is one of the great inventions of humankind that is designed, as many of these great inventions are, to overcome the knee-jerk reaction of the primitive brain, the reaction that makes us want to resolve tensions right now, the moment they happen, because we can't stand to live in that tugged and pulled condition. It's the reaction of the primitive brain that we know as the fight or flight syndrome. Plunge us into an experience of tension, and we want right now either to flee from it or to turn adversarial towards its source. Woolman chose a third way, and his witness is powerful, standing in the tragic gap and holding the tension in a way that opens new possibilities for a whole society. We have been trying to overcome the primitive brain for millennia. The whole journey of human civilization, I would argue, has been that of trying to create institutions that evoke other capacities within ourselves, capacities of mind and heart and soul, those places in the human self that know how to hold tension in a life-giving rather than a death-dealing way. Let me name just two or three of those and return to democracy in the process. Think for a moment about the arts, one of the most ancient and marvelous of human institutional inventions. All of the arts are animated by creative holding of tension. That's why they animate us. A good painting, a good musical composition, a good drama, a good novel, all must hold a creative tension between their elements, not only to keep us, to hold our interest, but to draw us empathetically into the experience that they have to offer, the reality they have to share. And that, it seems to me, is the civilizing impulse behind the arts, the holding of tension that draws us into an empathetic experience of the other and opens new possibilities in mind and heart and soul. Here's another great invention which it seems to me is laced with this same theme, the university, the liberal arts, science. At the root of all of these educational inventions is the notion that a truly educated person needs more than a command of a body of knowledge or a mastery of techniques. A truly educated person will have a tolerance for ambiguity, an appreciation of complexity and the contradictions inherent in it, a capacity to embrace paradox. So, education at its best teaches us to hold the tension of ideas in a reflective rather than a reactive way, calling on that part of the brain that isn't the primitive stem, where all we know how to do is fight or flight, but where we know how to hold things in a rich and evocative manner that open new possibilities in our world. The civilizing impact of science itself comes from the demand it lays upon us and the processes it gives us to entertain divergent observations and explanations, seeking whatever new truth may be opened by the tension they create, and always aware that every new truth we arrive at will be followed by yet another tension, driving the quest for truth even deeper. And finally, in this brief rehearsal of the parade of civilization, the institution called democracy, the genius of democracy, is that it does not propose a way to bring tension to an end. It does not propose a way to bring tension to an end, any more than great drama or great science does that. In political terms, proposing a way to bring tension to an end is ultimately the conceit, the delusion, and the evil of totalitarianism, the final solution. Political systems which propose to bring tension to an end always end in evil. Democracy is designed to allow us to hold tension in a life-giving way. The very structures of our government, executive, legislative, and judicial, serve as a complex loom on which to hold our tensions in ways that can lift us up rather than bring us down. Democracy is weakened when one branch co-opts the other. Driven by the desire to end tension and consolidate power in a single set of hands, which is always the wish dream of totalitarianism. When the tension-holding structures of democracy are weakened, our capacity to embrace human diversity is also weakened. The very diversity that has been one of our greatest gifts to the world and the most significant engine of our own advancement. Joseph Ellis, in his book American Creation, makes a strong point. Our democracy was designed to foster arguments, not settle them, he says. Democracy dismisses the fantasy that some leader or program will take us through the wilderness to the promised land, the final solution. The concern of the founders was not how to reach perfection, but how to achieve progress, how to live in a tragic milieu where evil will always be with us in a way that keeps creating light in the abiding darkness. The concern of the founders was to teach us how to live in this tragic gap.
You're listening to a recent speech by Parker Palmer, who spoke February 19th at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
So, how's it going with our long-term effort to free ourselves from the tyranny of the primitive brain and to learn to hold tension in a more life-giving way? Well, if we look back on September 11th, 2001, perhaps you, like I, can remember a period of a few weeks in there when the primitive brain was held at bay. And I have a vivid heart memory of what happened during that few weeks' time. Something better seemed possible, because people around the world who had suffered more than we have were identifying with us in our suffering. They were saying, "Today I am an American," even when their suffering had been caused by us directly or indirectly. There was in this shared suffering what can often come out of shared suffering, a sense of community, a profound sense of alignment with one another, a sense of common cause that always, always moves us toward something better, a better world. But it wasn't too very long after that the primitive brain arose. And this nation state did what nation states do. We sought to resolve the tension by striking back at anything that moved, without particular rationale, logic, data, or good reason, linking it to the source of our suffering, which is exactly what the primitive brain does. The great opening into something new closed down. And what has happened to democracy in the intervening years? Arguably, it has been significantly degraded. It's an old story. It's a sad story, full of suffering and death. But it is a story that need not be this way. The question becomes, how can we change the dance? The answer, I believe, is that we need to create and strengthen more and more settings where we can exercise the powers of the soul, the heart, and the mind at least as much as we continually exercise the primitive brain. We need to learn to do soul work. We need to learn to do heart work. We need to learn to do inner work. Call it what you will, but name it and claim it. It's the work that Abraham Lincoln was calling us to when he appealed to the better angels of our nature. And never forget that one of the great opportunities offered by democracy, but denied by totalitarianism, is the opportunity to do inner work, heart work, soul work, to do it in both public and private ways. Now, I know that when a phrase like soul work enters the public realm, there are people who roll their eyes, imagining that they are being given a sermon rather than a useful analysis of our problems and possibilities. But let me just say it straight. When we dismiss soul talk as romantic rather than realistic, we reflect an ignorance of human history. Study any great social movement. Study the women's movement. Study the black liberation movement in this country. Study the movements for liberation in Latin America, Eastern Europe, the bringing down of apartheid in South Africa. All movements that took us farther from totalitarianism and closer to democracy. These movements were animated in every case by people who had been stripped of all forms of external objective power, but who figured out, in a disciplined and focused way, how to access, consolidate, and deploy the only power that can never be taken away from us, the power of the human heart, the power of authentic selfhood, the power of the soul, the power that animated John Woolman and his community to make a great breakthrough in the history of this democracy. Let me make the case for the practical reality of inner work, heart work, soul work on a more microcosmic scale. Not too long ago, a study was completed by two scholars at the University of Chicago of school reform efforts in the city of Chicago during the decade of the 90s. Anthony Breich and Barbara Schneider looked at the massive efforts in the city of Chicago to help public schools serve kids better over the course of a decade. And they asked, what were the factors that ended up making some of those schools better servants of young people, better educators of children, while other schools failed miserably to improve at that, even declined at doing that over that decade? And they looked at all of the so-called realistic, objective factors that we attribute institutional success to in this society. They looked at how much money was being tossed at the schools. They looked at models of governance. They looked at up-to-date curricula. They looked at the most refined and sophisticated modes of in-service training and technique. And they found that not a one of those factors significantly distinguished between the schools that succeeded for kids and the schools that failed. Not a one of them. But they found one factor that explained a huge amount of the difference. And they call that factor relational trust. Relational trust. They found that if your school had high levels of relational trust at the beginning of the 90s and or a leadership cadre that cared about cultivating relational trust, your chances of serving kids better by the end of the 90s were 5 out of 7. They also found that if your school had low levels of relational trust at the beginning of the 90s and or a leadership cadre that did not believe that things like trust had anything to do with the real world, your chances of serving kids better by the end of the 90s were 2 out of 7. 5 out of 7, 2 out of 7. I took statistics across the bay. I don't remember all of it, but I remember that that's a significant statistical difference. And if you ask yourself what lies behind relational trust, I think the answer has to be inner work, soul work, heart work. What is it that allows us to trust each other. It's people sitting down and getting their own egos under control, setting aside that impulse that says, you're my competitor and I have to best you, and allows me to open to the possibility that you're my collaborator and we can do something better together. It's inner work that lays aside jealousy. It's inner work that offers forgiveness of self and other so that we can proceed in a flawed world, in our flawed institutions, out of our flawed selves, to do well on behalf of kids. I think there's a lot of real-world evidence that heart work, soul work, inner work makes a difference in practical reality. And here's an interesting piece of Brick and Schneider's findings. They found that that relationship between relational trust and, as I'm arguing, the inner work that makes trust possible, the relationship between that and educating kids held up no matter how you messed with those other factors. You could throw a lot of money at schools that had low levels of relational trust and not get good outcomes for kids. Does that remind you of any institutions you might have heard about or work in? Or you could take a school that has been unfairly deprived of material resources, build up the relational trust inside that building, and get good outcomes for kids 10 years down the road. That is realpolitik. It's not touchy-feely, and it's not romanticism. And we need to start taking it seriously if we want to restore our institutions and our democratic life. What can we do to foster soul work? Well, we can revisit those civilizing institutions that I mentioned a few moments ago. When No Child Left Behind drives the arts out of our schools, music, literature, painting, dance, replacing dialogue and discussion with memorization of facts so that kids can fit through standardized testing templates, when that happens, democracy is not well served. That seems to me to be an unarguable fact. When online learning drives face-to-face debate out of higher education, replacing the capacity to embrace paradox with sophisticated forms of information dumping, democracy is not well served. We can revisit those civilizing institutions and ask ourselves, what's going on there that either undermines or enhances the democratic experiment when it comes to helping young people and all of us, their elders, hold tension in a life-giving rather than death-dealing way, stand in the tragic gap, pulling ourselves and our whole society open to new and better possibilities. I think we can also learn to do soul work in more focused and dedicated forms. And this is what my colleagues and I, in our small and modest way, have been trying to do around the country for the last decade, through the Center for Courage and Renewal, through the lives of 25,000 people in the serving professions whom we have now touched, with programs that we call Circles of Trust that take people through a 2-year journey, rejoining soul and role. There are places to get details about this that I won't trouble you with today. I wrote a book called A Hidden Wholeness, trying to spell some of this out, and there's a website for the Center for Courage and Renewal at www.couragerenewal.org, where you can learn more details. Let me simply tell you a story that speaks to me about the power of circles of trust, quiet, focused, dedicated work to rejoin soul and role, the power of that kind of work to help revitalize democratic institutions and processes. A circle that I facilitated several years ago involved 25 people from Washington, D.C. They were all highly placed folk in government, appointed and elected, and all of them were standing in the tragic gap. The gap was between the high values and ideals that had called them into public service in the first place, and Washington truly is full of people like that, and the political pressures that kept eating away at those convictions, calling them to compromise and sell out on the things they most care about. There was a man in that circle to whom I was drawn because, having been in Washington for a decade, as he was for 25 years before that, he'd been a farmer in northeast Iowa, in the same part of that state that my great-grandparents farmed. And he sat in our circle of trust for 3.5 days, agonizing over a policy issue that was on his desk back in Washington, D.C., an administrative action that he could take that would contribute to the problem of rapidly thinning topsoil in the Midwest, the erosion of the richness of the land, environmental degradation, a small piece of it. And he kept saying, "My farmer's heart knows what I need to do about this, but all of the political pressures around me are in the opposite direction." And we surrounded him not with advice, not with fixes, not with saves, but with the kind of silence that people need to hear their own truth, to hear the soul speak, to hear identity and integrity emerge, to find again that North Star through which one wants to track one's life. On the final morning of the retreat, this man came to the circle looking very bleary-eyed. He said, "I didn't sleep much last night, but during the night, I understood what I need to do. I need to go back to D.C. and resolve this issue on behalf of my farmer's heart." There was a moment of respectful silence, and out of that, an honest, open question. When you do this, how will you respond to your boss, whom you have said is dead set against this resolution? And he said, "I think the most important thing I've learned during this retreat is that I don't report to my boss. I report to the land. I report to the land." There could be a great revolution in this society as teachers start to realize that they are not primarily accountable to the people who make and mandate the tests. They report to the kids. There could be a great revolution in this society as physicians and nurses realize that they are not primarily accountable to the rules of the HMO, but to the well-being of the patients. And this is precisely the discovery that people are making in this dedicated and focused form of soul work that we call rejoining soul and role. And it brings me great hope and a sense of promise to see it happen. That man returned to Washington, D.C., not with the resolution of attention, but with the sharpening of attention, the clarification of attention, attention that he would now have to stand in for a long time to come, as he realized that none of us ought to be on automatic pilot. We ought to be responding to that voice of truth, especially when it sets us over against the demands of institutional life. I'm going to close my remarks with one more image of what we need if we want the democratic experiment to continue. I've said we need to learn to stand in the tragic gap, as did John Woolman. Another way of saying it is we need to learn how to live creatively with broken hearts, because heartbreak is what happens when we hold significant tension. There are two ways for the heart to break, and most of us are acquainted with both of them. One is for the heart, this hard, closed thing, to be hit from outside or inside by some massive force that shatters it into a million pieces that we crawl around trying to reassemble, never quite able to do so. That's heartbreak in the conventional sense. But there's another form of heartbreak that is recommended by all the great wisdom traditions and that is known to people in or out of those traditions who have suffered great loss. And that's the breaking open of the heart. The opening of that closed fist of a heart into something larger and more capacious, into something capable of holding more of our own and the world's suffering, as well as its joy and possibilities. Holding tension that way, in a way that breaks the heart not into a million pieces, but open into greater capacity, is a spiritual act that's understood in all of the wisdom traditions I know anything about, and I think it is a habit of the heart that we need to revive in order to enter a time of healing and renewal of American democracy. I'll close with one of my favorite teaching stories from the great Hasidic tradition. The disciple comes to the rabbi and says, "Why does Torah tell us to take the words of love and truth and justice and lay them on our hearts? Why does Torah not say to put those words in our hearts?" And the great rabbi answers, "Because your heart in its natural state is too hard to absorb those words. But lay the words upon your heart, and life will soon enough break your heart, and then those words will have a chance to fall in to the center of your heart." Thanks very much.
Parker Palmer is a sociologist and author of books such as Let Your Life Speak and The Courage to Teach. He spoke February 19th in San Francisco at the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're hearing him on Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After his speech, he took questions from the Commonwealth audience and moderator Michael Lerner.
We are in the midst of one of the most extraordinary election cycles that any of us can remember in a long time. And young people have become engaged in the process in a way that we haven't seen for decades. As you watch this great drama play itself out on the national scene, what are your reflections about its implications for American democracy?
Well, I share your observation about the excitement, the energy, the promise and potential of what's happening as young people come into the political scene, back to the political scene in ways that I guess I didn't think I'd see again in my lifetime, having spent the 60s in Berkeley, which were wonderful years to the best of my memory. That's a statement about age and nothing else. I wasn't sure I'd ever see this again, and it's a joy and a delight to see it again. But in the context of what I said today, here's my reflection. Are we helping young people understand the heartbreaking possibilities of having hope? Will they stay in this messy, conflictual, tragic process only if it works out the way they want it to work out? Or will we, the elders, help them understand that heartbreak is part of the process, that it can open you into a larger form of participation and draw you deeper in, even when your candidate doesn't win, your issues don't win, your wish dreams aren't fulfilled? And I frankly don't think that we're teaching much of that. We don't teach the tragic dimension of life anymore. We participate in a very thin form of technological optimism, very thin soup that doesn't feed people in the trenches. But we don't have to look far for resources. I love to bring things to ground level. Talk to someone who has lost someone they dearly love. And find out from them how that crushing, devastating experience of loss can turn into an opening of the heart, which they will say eventually, as their grieving continues and deepens and turns from death to life, eventually has made them more open to the world. The lessons are all around us, and they can be applied to politics as well as personal life. I don't think there's much conversation between the elders and the younger about that, and I think we need it badly, and we need it now.
We have a question. We tend to live in enclaves of like-minded people who get their information and perspectives from the same sources. How do we reach beyond these enclaves to converse with those we disagree with?
Well, my gut response to that is we all have that problem, and we all need to get a life. We all need to understand that one of the great American maladies is boredom, and that boredom comes partly from constantly recycling ideas and indeed recycling the air we breathe with people who think like us and people who breathe like us. I do believe that boredom is a pathology in American life. I even believe that it's a pathology that helps create the very high levels of violence in this society. You get bored enough and you've got to liven things up, and so you strike out at something to make some noise, to create some action, to make waves. If we could diagnose our illness, and I use boredom as just one example, and find that its root system is that we keep recycling the same thinking, the same faces, the same convictions, the same lifestyles, we would start reaching out to others for the sake of our life enhancement. One of the things we know, for example, about a homogeneous ecosystem, about those Midwestern farmlands that used to have 250 species of plants on them and now have only two, is that these ecosystems, because they're homogeneous, are much more subject to degradation and death than a system that has organic variety on it. And exactly the same thing is true of our personal and social lives. We have to start making that link between otherness and diversity, not as a problem to be solved, but as a generative source of life itself.
Well, let me challenge that particular point about the relationship between biodiversity, where complexity is an absolute value, and you as a sociologist on social diversity. In sociology, is it not true that if you look at the Scandinavian countries, which, for example, were quite homogeneous, that sense that the other is in fact related to you through the homogeneity of the society creates an easier generosity toward others because you see them as sort of part of your community of humanity? And there is in sociology, as I understand it, a point in diversity where the diversity becomes challenging to the capacity to relate to the other as part of your kin. And so we are clearly in the United States creating an ever more complex social diversity.
Right.
And I would suggest that that's different from biodiversity, that biodiversity, an ecosystem, is a community of diversity that has grown up together over a long, long period of time, mm-hmm. where the biological species have worked out their related roles. Mm-hmm. In social diversity, it's a much more complex issue, and it seems to me there are people who challenge the assumption mm-hmm. that a endless diversity mixes easily with the kind of generative connectivity that you so eloquently speak to.
I think it's a fair point, an absolutely fair point, but I think what we have to do, the way we have to think about a complex society is we have to speed up the evolutionary process by creating these contexts, these focused and disciplined contexts, where people can reap the rewards of diversity rather than always experiencing otherness as a source of threat because they're ignorant about it. They haven't experienced it. They haven't confronted it. I'd also suggest that your theory about Scandinavia and indeed other parts of Europe may have been true 20 or 30 years ago, but now as these societies are facing genuine diversity, no longer romanticized forms of diversity, they are finding within themselves as much racism, as much intolerance, as much brittleness and bigotry as anything we've known in this society. So I think sometimes the question is, have we really tested our romance about otherness against concrete experience? And once we test it against concrete experience and run into the problems inherent in it, are we providing those catch basins or those pockets of possibility where people can learn something about the richness as contrasted with the threat?
Now, you speak of speeding up the process of evolution, and it actually brings up a fundamental question about your thinking about this. Do you believe that we actually move forward over time in the organization of the human psyche, both individually and collectively, toward higher levels of consciousness, if you will, or deeper levels, at which we have a greater capacity to absorb diversity and complexity and challenge? Or are we really a species sort of caught with its own intrinsic capacities, again, meeting new challenges with the psyche that we had 2,000 years ago?
It's a bigger question than I'm able to answer, but let me answer it anyway. That's how I got a PhD, answering questions that I had no idea about and pretending that I did. I think that it's a both and. I with you, and I know that your work, Michael, your wonderful work at Commonweal, is a lot about consciousness and the evolution of consciousness. With you, I believe deeply, profoundly, I've seen it in my own life, that consciousness can evolve to a new and higher state. I also believe that the primitive brain will always be with us. And until universities like Yale start learning how to educate it, we're going to keep ending up in national spasms of the primitive brain that do none of us any good. So the both and is another way of talking about the tragic gap, I think, that will always be with us. I'm of all the things I think, and most of my thoughts ultimately are very simple ones, I think that any projection of utopia, any projection of the final resolution of conflict, any projection of the light that banishes the darkness, any projection of goodness that eliminates evil, is a totalitarian delusion and a snare and a very bad place to go. Again, this has to do with helping young people and helping me and us of my generation hang in with this broken, flawed political process that needs us for the long haul, not just when it's going our way. And again, we have examples in everyday life. Parents know what it is to hang in with a child when that child's life is not going his way, her way, let alone your way. We know about tenacity. We know about moral courage. And we need to talk more with each other about these things and encourage, as Lincoln said, the better angels of our nature, which doesn't mean that the dark angels aren't in there flapping their wings right along with them.
Here's a question. You say democracy is about holding tensions, but our way of electing leaders does not seem to be congruent with that. Any thoughts about this paradox?
Yeah. I think that's a very astute observation. Here's one that I genuinely don't know what to do about. The John Woolman story, one of its most remarkable features, as I'm sure you were aware as you were listening to it, is that he had a community that even though it disagreed with him, it didn't throw him out, it didn't marginalize him, it didn't disown him, it said, we'll hold the tension with you. And part of why they did that, part of why they were able to do that, is that they were committed to a decision-making process that was consensual rather than majority rule. Some of you might be interested in the fact that the historic reason why Quakers refused to make decisions by majority rule is they regard majority rule as a form of violence. It contradicts their nonviolent posture in life, that whenever 51% can tell 49% where to go, violence has been done. And incidentally, there's empirical evidence for that. If you look at those 51-49% votes where people think the decision has been made, but the 49% spend the next three generations undermining whatever that decision was, not just the next day or the next week, but the next three generations. So our way of electing presidents, which of course can't be done consensually, does depend on majority rule, and there's a sticking point for me right there. But there is this creative chaos of the process leading up to that vote. And I trust messes. I trust disorder. I trust disarray, because it's what totalitarianism wants to clean out of the system. One of the marks of a totalitarian society is that there aren't any spontaneous rallies on street corners and all the streets are clean. Mess is part of the creative energy of life, and the messiness of our pre-election process, what's important about it, of course, is that it be made as transparent as humanly possible. And one of the things that keeps undermining our democracy is all the hiddenness of a process, of a mess that should be more transparent.
Parker Palmer, sociologist, author, and founder of the Center for Courage and Renewal. If you missed part of this hour's speech by Parker Palmer, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may do so by visiting our website. It's wordforword.org. When you go there, you can hear this week's program, subscribe to our free weekly podcast, and join a discussion about the ideas in this and previous programs. You can also search our archives and listen to speakers such as journalist Anthony Lewis on free speech, former NBC News anchor Tom Brokaw on the 60s, and Barbara Slavin and Abbas Milani on Iran-U.S. relations. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.